This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Isn't it equal?
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and with me in the studio is Carey Jr. II. He is our show's producer.
Good day, Stephen.
Hey, Carey.
How you doing?
Good. So today we want to come back to the presidential campaign, which, of course, is a little bit of news these days, almost every day.
Just a little bit of news.
What people are thinking about. We're getting ready for the Democratic Party and its national convention next week in Chicago. That'll be the next big sort of event and episode in this narrative. But today what we want to talk about is the role that Middle East politics, and in particular this war that has been waged for nearly a year now in Gaza, is playing inside the Democratic Party. During the primaries, we saw a lot of voters upset about the United States support for Israel decide not to vote for President Joe Biden, who was really the only candidate on the ballot. They voted uncommitted instead. But we haven't really talked much about this since Biden stepped aside and Kamala Harris has become the presumptive nominee. And she's at least voicing a little different approach to all of this. But how different is it, I think, is one of the questions.
Right.
And whether what she says can welcome those people who were uncommitted voters back into the party's big tent.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we also had conversations, too, about the fact that former President Joe Biden was withdrawing from the race. And we were wondering, you know, at the time, if that would change in terms of like whoever the candidate is that would replace him and who could be the candidate that would support the folks who are voting uncommitted in the primary. And so now we're kind of following up with that conversation. And then on top of that, the Democratic Party also kind of promotes itself as this party of inclusivity, this party that no matter what you look like or what you believe, that you belong in our party. And so we're wondering now, with this kind of fissure that we're seeing on this issue, whether that is still like that's a point of tension, and whether they're able to still maintain that identity, include everyone in their ideals, depending on, like, even though there's issues like this that can be pretty contentious.
Yeah, I mean, and we should be clear, you know, both parties face this kind of big tent issue from time to time, right? Neither of them is monolithic in terms of the idea that everybody agrees. But we do see different behavior, I think, in the two parties when these things come up. I always feel like Republicans are just a little more disciplined when it comes to actually supporting candidates and voting for them than Democrats can sometimes be. I mean, the feelings that, you know, Democratic constituencies have about candidates often result in lower voter turnout in some kind of crucial elections sometimes. And I think we don't see that as frequently on the Republican side. For them, it's more a comparative issue, right? Maybe they're angry about an issue that their candidate is wrong on in their eyes, but they aren't willing to let the other side win no matter what.
That's interesting. Well, I mean, I think we're running this back with two pretty good guests today. In our previous conversation where we talked a little bit about the potential alternate Democratic candidate, we spoke with Abbas Alawi. He's back to join us again on this show. He's in studio with us. He is the uncommitted delegate from Michigan and a former staffer for Cori Bush. We also are going to be joined by Andy Levin, who is the distinguished senior fellow for the Center for American Progress, a former congressman of Michigan's 9th district. And I'm looking forward to the conversation to see now what they think about where Vice President Kamala Harris stands on the issue.
Just a few days till the convention.
And the convention's around the corner. Yep.
Okay, Andy Levin and Abbas Alawi, welcome to Created Equals. It's great to have both of you here.
Thanks, Stephen.
It's great to hear your voice.
Yeah. So Andy, I'm gonna start with you, and I want to kind of row back a little bit in time to the time when you were a member of Congress and then decided not to be a member of Congress any longer, and I want to have you talk just a little bit about that decision and the role that Middle East politics played in that decision inside the Democratic Party.
Sure. Well, of course, I didn't make a decision. You're right. There was a complicated process, and let's really put it in context, right, Stephen? We had a redistricting mm-hmm. after the 2020 census. Michigan lost a seat again in the U.S. House of Representatives. We once had 19, and we were going this time from 14 to 13. We're mm-hmm. not shrinking, but, you know, as Michigan kind of stays at 10 million people, other states are growing.
Yeah.
So our share of the seats in Congress in the House goes down. And I was thrown into an unwanted primary with a colleague. And what you're referring to is my colleague that I was up against in the primary, Haley Stevens, mm-hmm. Fully embraced AIPAC and the right wing on Israel crowd. And I had written a bill called the Two-State Solution Act. And I've just really long been a champion for what I consider to be a simple proposition, that there's no way to have peace and security and self-determination for my people, the Jewish people in the Holy Land, without also giving those rights and powers to the Palestinian people mm-hmm, who've mm-hmm. lived on the land forever. And the Two-State Solution Act said, well, let's go. You know, Palestinian leadership, Israeli leadership, there are things you need to do to come together. These right-wing on Israel groups did not like that. And they spent millions of dollars to defeat me in that primary, yeah. dark money and so-called hard money, you know, yeah. gathering contributions from my opponent. Yeah. So, you know, they've also gone after a lot of other people, mostly people of color. I'm like the Jewish boy from Detroit they went after. I think honestly, they couldn't stand the idea that somebody like me, a former synagogue president, I was a synagogue president until I ran for Congress. Then I felt like I better give that up. And the son of, you know, the two siblings who are the longest serving members in the history of Congress as siblings, mm-hmm. My dad, Sandy Levin, my uncle, Carl Levin, fixtures of the Jewish community. It was very upsetting to them that I said, look, I love the Jewish people. I love, Israel, but we also have to have Palestinians having full rights too, and political rights and self-determination in the land. And everybody who lives on the land needs justice, and they have to figure out together how they can live together. Yeah. And so that is part of my history for sure.
Yeah. And I guess what I was referring to in terms of, you know, choosing was, I felt like there was a way you could have, you could have turned away from some of the things that you had said and done that might have backed off, these opponents at some point, and you chose to stand by your principles, and it cost you your seat. Let's roll the time capsule back forward then, and have you assess for us right now what that looks like inside the Democratic Party, this issue about the Middle East, about support for Israel, about the war in Gaza. You're still a Democrat, Andy. What do you make of where we are and what we're hearing from the Democratic Party and its ticket about this issue?
Yeah, well, first let me just say that now it's 2024. Almost 2 years later from November 2022. And I just feel great about what I did. I can't imagine doing what you correctly suggest I could have, mm-hmm. which is kind of say, well, forget about my principles or even the policy I think is correct, which is kind of the policy of every Democratic and Republican administration of this century besides Trump, you know? Mm-hmm. So I feel like that was right. And I still feel like there's a tremendous amount of energy in the Democratic base for this position. After all, the vast majority of Democrats and Americans, but even more higher percentage of Democrats, have supported an immediate and full ceasefire from almost the beginning of this war. We supported President Biden's staff, the Secretary of Defense, and others who said to Israel before they started this war, you know, this war, well, gee, what's your military objective? Quote unquote, wiping out Hamas isn't a real thing. You know, we never, since World War II, we never wiped out any, however much we hate them or objectively we think they're terrible, we didn't wipe out the North Koreans or the Viet Cong or people in Central America or, you know, whatever, people we didn't like in Iraq or Afghanistan. And so, you know, I think many Democrats are right where I am, which is that we want justice and peace in the Holy Land. We want the Jewish people and the Christian and Muslim Palestinian people who live there all to have their rights. It's tough to figure out, but we have to get about figuring it out instead of this horrifying cycle of violence. Stephen, I mean, 40,000 people dead in Gaza, hostages still being held there, many people, many Palestinians dead in the West Bank, possible conflagration, you know, involving Lebanon. And I mean, the whole stuff with the Houthis that arose out of this, this is not going in a good direction. It's not in the national security interest of the United States. And we really need a change of policy. And I know we'll talk about this, but I'm very hopeful that Kamala Harris as president will bring it.
I'm going to come to that soon. We're going to talk more in depth about what Harris says. But let me quickly ask you before we get to Abbas Alawiya, do you plan to vote for the Democrats in November? Are you somebody who's upset enough about this that you're considering not casting a vote?
No. And I've been clear about this since before our primary on February 27th, Stephen. I said that I thought these young people like Abbas Alawiya, and I have to, you know, you didn't say it in the intro, so I feel like for full disclosure, you know, I'm a huge fan of my co-guest here.
Right.
He came to Washington with me when I won, and I was so proud of his rise to be a legislative director for another member and then a chief of staff for a third member. And, you know, I think he's providing amazing leadership for the community here now. But you know, everybody should know that. But I, even when I said, look, I'm in favor of people voting uncommitted on February 27th in our primary, I had two reasons for it, Stephen. Number one was I really felt objectively like we needed to change policy on Gaza. But secondly, I wanted to save Joe Biden. And I need him to be president, or, you know, at that time, I needed him to beat Trump. He was going to be the nominee. I don't see any way for him or now Vice President Harris, or frankly, any nominee, to win the Electoral College without winning Michigan. And I don't see how we could win Michigan without changing policy on Gaza, because we're the most densely Arab American state. We have many other Muslim Americans who are so upset about this. Remember the AME bishops writing about this, and thousands of black pastors and many people in the African American community who are upset. Progressives, Jewish progressives, students on our campuses. I mean, Stephen, even though Biden beat Trump by 14 times in 2020, as Trump beat, you know, Hillary by in 2016 in Michigan, he still only won by 154,000 votes in Michigan.
Yeah,
and
close.
I just, I'm worried, you know, so I want to us to change policy for the right reason. I mean, for, you know, for substantive reasons, but also for political reasons. But I was always clear that I was going to vote. I would have voted for President Biden, and I'm certainly voting for our amazing vice president. And we're just trying to help her, you know, navigate this in a way where people, everybody in our amazing state and our beloved, fantastic, amazing, you know, Palestinian and broader Arab American and Muslim communities can feel great about voting for her.
Abbas Alawiya, I want to bring you into the conversation here. I imagine you're packing for Chicago next week, getting ready to go to the convention. But what is your frame of mind as you do that? The last time you were here, we were talking about Joe Biden, and the fact that you know, you still had major issues with the things that he was saying and the policy that he is prosecuting in the Middle East. Everything has changed since you and I talked. There's an entirely different ticket. So I'm curious about what your temperature is here on all of this right now.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Stephen. And you know, we're here talking about issues of Middle East politics, issues of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans, Palestinian Americans in the Democratic Party. And before starting to talk about that, I want to be clear where we are at right now with the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And the Republican Party, here we are over 10 months into this war, where over 40,000 Palestinians on the conservative end have been killed using U.S. bombs by the Israeli military. And still, on the Republican side of things, there isn't a single federal official who has come out saying there should be a ceasefire. So for someone like me who has family in southern Lebanon right now that is living constantly under the bombs, there is no place for me in the Republican Party. I don't feel that there is. There is a place for me in the Democratic Party, thanks in large part to the leadership of people like Congressman Andy Levin, without whom someone like me, a southern Lebanese kid from Dearborn, wouldn't have had the opportunity to go and work on Capitol Hill. But that experience of going to work on Capitol Hill, even during Democratic leadership, oftentimes was an experience of going to work in institutions that were actively funding the harming and killing of people like me. Because for whatever reason in our politics, there is just this sort of assumed idea that Palestinian lives, Arab lives, Muslim lives matter just a little bit less. That bombing happens over there and we send bombs there and they just die. That's just what happens. And I think that's unacceptable. I think that's unacceptable as an American who's paying tax dollars, who is horrified by the idea that they're being used to kill children en masse. And so that's why, as a Democrat, I and others here in Michigan joined together around this uncommitted strategy to send a message to President Biden and now still to Vice President Harris that we need to see an update to this Gaza policy because it's been disastrous. It's, to say the least, it's been genocidal. There isn't anywhere in Gaza that's safe, and that's being done using U.S. taxpayer funds and bombs. And so I was very encouraged when Vice President Harris became the nominee. I mean, certainly, as someone who was a congressional staffer, I worked with Senator Harris's team, worked with Vice President Harris's team. I know that she's in touch with Arab and Muslim and Palestinian community members mm-hmm. in a way that we just didn't see with President Biden, unfortunately. And so I'm hoping that we can get the message through. But I think what's essential at this point is if Vice President Harris wants to begin repairing a very strained relationship with people for whom Gaza is a top policy issue, then part of what they need to see is an update to the policy. Because what Vice President Harris is saying is, I support a ceasefire. I support a ceasefire. Yet day after day, we see more and more weapons and bombs, including offensive weapons and bombs, that are going to Netanyahu's far right wing government without any consequences. He's killed thousands of kids. There are no consequences. And so it feels hypocritical at this point. It feels hypocritical for us to keep to be saying, for Vice President Harris to be saying, I support a ceasefire, but for there to be no discussion of how we stop fueling the violence
right.
with more bombs. And so that's why we're asking for an updated policy.
So what's your leverage point at this point? I mean, if, for instance, as you say, you don't have a place in the Republican Party and you think it's important that that the Democratic Party win so that the Republicans don't, get control of that policy. What's the point, I guess, you press on to force Harris and Waltz and the rest of the party to take this as seriously as you want it?
Yeah. You know, it's a very, very challenging reality to sit with that people who are anti-war in our country, certainly Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, Palestinian Americans, but young voters, you know, people of conscience all around our country, we do not at this moment have enough power even to stop a mass killing campaign. Mm-hmm. That's a very difficult reality to sit with. And so I think what we need to be focused on at this point is how do we grow our people power? How do we grow the power for people who don't believe that we should be funding endless wars, who understand that that is not a sustainable foreign policy, and that's certainly not a sustainable campaign strategy. And I think what that requires is organizing in our communities like the Uncommitted campaign did, where we mobilized, we contacted over 1.5 million voter contacts through our campaign. That's just what we did in Michigan. Nationally, local organizers in state after state mobilized, and we got over 740,000 voters. These aren't fringe actors, as some on the right will try to dismiss us as. These aren't people who aren't Democrats. These are Democratic voters who are voting, including key swing states, saying we need an update to the Gaza policy. So this is an articulation of an idea that is central to the base. We want the killing to stop. Mm. And so what we're saying is, Vice President Harris, if you want us to help you mobilize the voters that we're in touch with and that we've built credibility with at a time when, unfortunately, President Biden was failing to give them something to vote for as it relates to peace and justice, then we need to see an update to your policy. I have ideas about what that could look like, and we're engaging Vice President Harris's team and DNC leadership to try and make sure that she comes out with something substantive, a statement, a speech, engage with us meaningfully and tell us how you would be different than the last 10 months. And I think, so that's the leverage point, is our people power, is Can we get something right now from Vice President Harris that demonstrates to us meaningfully that our ability to continue organizing for an anti-war future will be increased with her presidency as compared with the disaster of the last 10 months of genocide. Yeah. I hope that will be the case.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking with former Congressman Andy Levin, an uncommitted delegate to the Democratic National Convention, Abbas Alawiya, about the Mideast policy inside the Democratic Party, what the Harris-Waltz ticket is saying, what they might do if they are elected. We want to get going with you, the listeners, on the phones and on social as well. Call and let us know what you make of the Mideast policy that has been in place in the Democratic Party for a long time. Is it changing because Kamala Harris is now the nominee? Is it changing in the way that makes you more confident about it? Is it a reason that perhaps you might not vote for the Democrats or vote at all in November? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Created Equal or at WDET. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. More Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. And today we're talking about the effect of Middle East policy inside the Democratic Party this year. Vice President Kamala Harris is now the presumptive nominee for president and is getting ready for the Democratic National Convention next week in Chicago, but looming still pretty large over the party and its ticket is the question of its support for the current policy in the Middle East, which is to fund and back Israel in its war in Gaza, which has claimed 40,000 Palestinian lives. And that may be a gross understatement. I think it's entirely possible there are far more casualties that have resulted from that war. There are a lot of folks inside the Democratic Party who don't support that and who have been pretty loudly expressing their displeasure with it. The question is whether that matters in a party that is also quite close to interests that support Israel. How do you manage the tension between those two poles inside one party that depends on both constituencies for its political success? We've got two great guests helping us sort through that. Andy Levin is a distinguished senior fellow for the Center for American Progress, former congressman in Michigan's old 9th district. Also with us is Abbas Alawiya. He is an uncommitted delegate from Michigan to the Democratic National Convention. He's a spokesperson for the Listen to Michigan campaign. He has also worked on Capitol Hill for Andy Levin and lots of other folks. We want to hear from you as well on the phones. Give us a call and let us know what you make of this tension inside the Democratic Party over the Middle East policy of Joe Biden and the emerging, I guess, Middle East policy of Kamala Harris. Is this something you're paying attention to as we get ready for the fall campaign? Is it something that could affect what you do in November on Election Day? Would it cause you to maybe not vote for a Democrat if they don't change this policy? And if you don't, what would you do? Would you not vote at all? Would you vote for another party or another candidate? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter, hashtag created equal or at WDET. I want to talk before we get to calls, and we've already got people queuing up to be part of this conversation, but I want to talk just a little about the opposition inside the party to the uncommitted voters, AIPAC, which is the lobbying arm of the pro-Israeli constituency in this country, has been really active this cycle, trying to make sure that Democrats up and down the ticket are sufficiently in favor of Israeli policy. AIPAC has spent $15 million on campaign contributions for Democrats this year. There were some key primary races where their support was pivotal. Cori Bush, who Abbas, you used to work for, lost her primary in Missouri last week. AIPAC spent $9 million attacking Bush in ads. Jamal Bowman, who was another Democratic congressperson from New York, lost his primary. AIPAC spent $14.5 million supporting his challenger. It seems to me that the effectiveness of this strategy is part of your problem. In other words, that the uncommitted vote got a lot of attention and got a lot of press, but it had no consequences for Joe Biden. It didn't cost anybody anything. Meanwhile, AIPAC is very effective at showing candidates that when they don't support their side of things, that they can get rid of you. I wonder about that balance and whether it worries you that the Democratic Party can't or won't take you seriously enough to change that policy. And in other words, are you overmatched in the argument about which constituency inside the party ought to have the loudest voice? Abbas, go ahead.
That's a really important question that you're asking, Stephen. And again, I will sort of ground us in what we're up against on the Republican side. When we're talking about Donald Trump, we're talking about someone whose plans would be deeply destructive for our social policy agenda here in this country, but also on issues of Middle East policy. Donald Trump's ideas around Palestinians are let's kill people faster. Fund the annexation of the West Bank. Let's get his son-in-law million-dollar condos on Gaza Beach so that already displaced Palestinians can be further displaced. That's the destructive that's a destructive agenda we're dealing with on the other side. Now, it just so happens that the group that you're describing, AIPAC, has a whole bunch of donors who are actively funding Donald Trump. That is their vision for how our government's relationship should be with the Israeli government. A lot that group in particular is a champion for Benjamin Netanyahu. In my mind, Benjamin Netanyahu is not a partner for peace. He is a purveyor of fascism in the same way that Donald Trump is. So I think we need to ask ourselves, you're talking about, you know, these numbers of how much AIPAC spent in Cori Bush's race or Jamal Bowman's race. Just, you know, to make sure we're all on the same page, AIPAC's influence in those two races made those two races the two most expensive races in the history of our country. This is not normal. This is a subversion of our democracy. And so we have to ask ourselves, why is it that that particular group or other right-wing elements are simultaneously pushing our politics towards Benjamin Netanyahu's murderous policies, and at the same time eliminating the people, spending more money than we've ever seen, trying to eliminate the strongest champions of human rights for everyone. I want a Democratic Party that is the Democratic Party of Andy Levin and Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush and so many others, where it's all of us. It's working class people. It's Arabs and Jewish folks and black folks all coming together and saying, this is for us. We get to determine what is the best use of our tax dollars. I think groups like the ones you've mentioned are trying to subvert our democracy, not strengthen it. And that really worries me.
But AIPAC, and you're right, AIPAC is not an interest that's aligned with one particular party. It supports candidates in different parties and, of course, has donors who are from different parties. But there's a large part of the support for AIPAC that is inside the Democratic Party. And these were Democrats in Missouri and New York who voted Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman out. The money, of course, always matters in these races. But I guess what I'm trying to get at is, how does that make you feel as part of the Democratic Party? Or does it make you feel part of the Democratic Party? If you've got this other constituency that not only is opposed to what you believe, but is also as powerful as it is, where do you go? How do you match that?
I believe that in the long term, people power will win. I believe that in the long term, war is not a sustainable strategy, whether be it a foreign policy strategy or a campaign strategy. I also believe what we know are the cold hard facts, that the majority of Democratic voters and indeed voters in our country support a ceasefire, something that AIPAC has been working against. The majority of voters in our country support peace and justice. And so when you look at how AIPAC is engaging in these races, even though they are articulating that this is their number one issue, Israeli policy, the millions of dollars that they're pouring in to spread lies and misinformation about Jamal Bowman, for example, or Cori Bush or anyone else, you look at their ads. They have nothing to do with AIPAC. It's not like they're going to Democratic voters and saying, here's Cori Bush's record on Palestinian human rights, and here's the other guys, and you know, we think you should vote for the other guy because of Israel. No, they're saying, they're just spreading, you know, sort of like this fear-mongering about every other issue except for this issue. And that makes me feel like, well, actually, the people want peace. The people want justice, and it's these powerful, the influence of dark money in our politics that's breaking our politics. I think we need to change that. I don't understand how, it still doesn't make sense to me, just as a regular everyday person, why it's okay or legal for millions and millions of dollars to be spent to influence our elections in this way. It feels like subversion of democracy.
Yeah. Andy Levin, I want to bring you back into the conversation here. You, of course, were a member of Congress and had to deal with these opposing constituencies from an office holding perspective. I want to compare your experience to the experience of another Michigan Democrat, Rashida Tlaib, who still is in Congress, of course, but she was censored by Congress for her comments about what was happening in Gaza last year. And what I remember, the one of the strongest forces I remember making that happen was, of course, the Republican caucus, which has control of the House, was behind making sure that she was censured for this. At the same time, you had Democrats inside the caucus also supporting this, though, and saying that you know, what she said was inappropriate. And I want to make it really clear that you know, Rashida has said over and over again that her criticism is always of the Israeli government and what Benjamin Netanyahu is doing. It is not of Israel or its right to exist. But that didn't matter. You know, they had the votes to censure her. Give us a sense, Andy, of what that's like to be part of Congress and have this push and pull tension of these two constituencies and how you work it out. I mean, in your case, it ended in a primary loss, like Cori Bush or Jamal Bowman. But even while you're in office, how do you manage all this? And then again, does it make you feel as though you have a place in the Democratic Party?
Yeah, Stephen, the thing I would emphasize is that this is a complete distortion of the Democratic Party. So, for example, 22 people, as I recall, 22 Democrats voted to censure Rashida Tlaib. Mm-hmm. That means that like 80 to 90% of them didn't.
Right. Yes.
So come on. I mean, the vast, vast majority of Democrats in the House refused to censure her for stating her beliefs passionately. And I just want to emphasize, you know, AIPAC is not a Democratic group, capital D or maybe small d, but it's not a Democratic Party constituency. And it's just crucial to understand that most of the money they are spending to defeat progressive Democrats, mm-hmm, is coming from Republican mega donors, billionaires, who, as Abbas said earlier, support Donald Trump. This is a big problem for the Democratic Party leadership, because, Stephen, the fossil fuel industry isn't dumb. The tobacco industry isn't dumb. Mm-hmm. The big pharma isn't dumb. These generally Republican interest groups could say, oh, gee, thank you, AIPAC. This is a great model. We won't just pick the Republican nominees in the, you know, Republican primaries. We'll pick the Democrats too. And if the Democratic Party allows, if really this is a broad political science theory, just think about it. Take yourself back if you took a political science class in college. If your poli-sci professor said to you, well, what is there a problem if most of the spending in the primary of one party comes from the other party? You'd say, well, each party should pick its own candidate.
Yeah.
So this is a distortion of democracy. And as Abbas also pointed out, they are not winning over Democrats on this issue. They're not talking about Israel and Palestine at all in this millions of dollars of avalanches of advertisements on television and radio and social media. They're not being honest at all about what their interest is. The vast majority of Democrats are with us on this issue. They want justice for Jews and Muslims and Christians, everybody living on the land in, you know, Israel and Palestine. And I feel like we will, you know, we have to find a way to move forward on this. Donald Trump is a disaster for the Palestinian people and for anybody who's queer or homeless or has, you know, disabilities or many other people who, you know, are great Americans, you know, citizens and people living here who need their rights, and people abroad. So we have to defeat Donald Trump. And we're just saying we really want to help Vice President Harris, who's in a very difficult position because she's not the president.
Right.
And President
she does
Biden
not set the policy now.
Policy.
That's
so
right.
What is she supposed to do? But we do hope that she can find a way to continue really going beyond that amazing way she punched through in the anniversary of Bloody Sunday speech, where she clearly showed that she hears the and she sympathizes with the the horror that people feel over what's happening in Gaza.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we need to take one more quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Bas Alawia and Andy Levin, and we are going to get to you, the listeners, on the phones and on social. If you'd like to join us, 313-577-1019 is the number. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag created equal or at WDET, and we can make you part of the program that way. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Listening to Created Equal on WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've joined us. We're talking about Mideast policy and the effect it's having on politics inside the Democratic Party as we get ready for the Democratic National Convention to start next week in Chicago. Kamala Harris is now the presumptive nominee. How different is her sense of all of this from Joe Biden? And is it enough different for uncommitted voters, people who sat out the Democratic primary essentially and did not vote for President Joe Biden? Is Kamala Harris's difference enough to attract them back inside the Democratic Party's tent? We're talking with Andy Levin, a former congressman from here in Michigan, about that, as well as with Bas Alawia, who is an uncommitted delegate to the convention next week. We want to hear from you as well. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. And you can go to Twitter and hashtag created equal or at WDET. I want to go to the phones here and get listeners involved in the conversation. Alicia and Troy, you're up first. Alicia, what is on your mind?
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a reliable Democratic voter. I'm in Andy's old district. Not Arab American, but know and love many who are. And I honestly hadn't paid that much attention to what AIPAC was up to until Andy's primary,
mm-hmm.
and was completely horrified at how he was forced out. And that's when my eyes really started opening, and that was a mask off moment for me. And so my point is, I really don't think that this is only an Arab American issue. This mm-hmm. has been a huge topic amongst many voters I know, people who are very middle of the road Democratic voters, people who don't really watch the news that much, almost every single person I know under 40. And I think Democrats have lost the support of a generation of young voters because of the callousness and corruption that's been exposed. So the masks are off, and I don't think that's going to go away with just a new face at the top of the ticket.
Okay, so Alicia, tell me what you're going to do then. We're going to have an election in November. Presumably, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are the Democratic ticket, and Donald Trump and J.D. Vance are the Republican mm-hmm. ticket. Do you go to the polls that day? And if you do, how do you vote?
I'll definitely go to the polls, and we have to wait and see how they act.
Okay, so
and
what they
propose. So
right.
I'm not decided.
You're not decided yet. Okay, all right, no. Alicia, I really appreciate that call and that perspective. I mean, that's a powerful thing to say about the election that's coming up. Let's go next to Daniel in Detroit. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on again, Stephen. You and I have been talking about money and politics for a long time, mm-hmm. and this was a sobering show for me. That I mean, this. These super PACs and what they're doing is, this has to be stopped. And how do we do this? I wanted to talk to you and your guest on your show. How do we stop this? Can we take Michigan and make it an example for the rest of the country? Can we tell the super PACs that you're not going to spend your money on our airwaves in Michigan? Mm-hmm. Can we stop them from doing this? Can we pull money out of politics in Michigan and make Michigan an example for the rest of the country? Because it has to be stopped.
It's a great.
It's destroying the democracy. I mean, it's money the super PACs are destroying our democracy, and what do we do about it?
Daniel, it's a great question, and I'm glad you called and asked. Andy Levin, I'll start with you. Of course, you know, you can't talk about this without talking about what the Supreme Court did in Citizens United, which essentially equated speech with money in perpetuity for our country, and that means that it is much harder to limit the influence of money in politics. At the same time, they haven't said anything about at least disclosing and being more upfront about money when it comes into politics, whose money it is, and what purpose it is serving. But you were in Congress. Talk about how and whether we might make Michigan an example, a better example, I guess, when it comes to money in politics.
Yeah, well, Stephen, I have to give a shout out to my former colleague John Sarbanes, who's retiring from Congress this year, because he was our leader on what we called to show how much we agreed with the caller. We called our bill on this HR1 to get, you know, do everything we can aside from overturning Citizens United, which has to happen, you know, but that's a longer term problem. There are a lot of things that can be done in federal law, but we will be talking in Chicago around, not on the, in the official agenda, but around the convention, about things that can be done to reduce this toxic role that dark money and big money plays in our politics. Mm-hmm. State parties potentially can make rules about who they nominate for offices. So that's an interesting area. And there's also a lot that can happen in federal and state policy. So I that's why I want the first caller to come out and vote Democratic anyway, because there's no question, if we have a Democratic administration and Democratic majorities in the House and Senate, we can pass meaningful legislation. I'll just give one example that you raised, Stephen, sunshine. My little part of HR1 was saying that the shareholders of corporations supposedly own the corporation, right? And so they have the right to know in real time what money the people they hire to run the corporation are spending on politics. Mm-hmm. That would be a big change. And there are many things that we could do like that to reduce this horrible effect. But it's sacrilegious to our secular democracy, if I can mix metaphors, to say that money equals speech. Yeah. We're all equal. We're all one citizen, and we ought to have something like, you know, equal power, not, you know, you're a billionaire, so you have a billion times more power than I do. That's disgusting.
Yeah. Abbas, it seems that, you know, one of your principal challenges is you're overmatched when it comes to money. I mean, the support for Israel is very heavily financially backed. The truth is that the other side of that coin doesn't have as much. And that means that the outcomes in our system, at least, are frequently going to go against you.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciated your first caller as well, and both questions, but your first caller, Alicia from Troy, making clear that this is an issue that it's not just Arab and Muslim and Palestinian Americans who feel strongly about. Like, let's talk about the uncommitted vote, for example. Uncommitted earned over 10% of the vote in 75 out of 85 counties here in Michigan. This is something that people feel in our bones. And so what I believe is that if we organize regular everyday people and let them in on the strategy, here's what Uncommitted did. We said, hey, this is the Democratic primary. We're gonna claim the box, Uncommitted, and to apply pressure to our elected leaders, because they're not hearing us. They're listening more to the money than they are to the people. So we're gonna do this strategy. And if you agree with the strategy, join us. And a lot of people joined us. And so what we're saying now is, let's keep up the leverage of the people. Let's continue telling Vice President Harris, hey, we need you to differentiate your policy from the disaster of the last 10 months. And the Democratic National Convention is an important time to do that, an important opportunity to do that, to unite the party so that we can, you know, save lives in the short term, and but also so that we can, you know, pivot and focus on beating Donald Trump, and so that in the long term, we can continue organizing for a more humane policy that is more reflective of where the Democratic base is.
Yeah. Okay, we are out of time, but I really want to thank Andy Levin and Abbas Alawiya for being here for this really important conversation. You were both great. Thank you for joining us on Created Equal.
Thanks so much, Stephen. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks for your great journalism. Take care, everybody.
Okay, that's going to do it for us on Created Equal. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our program director is Adam Fox. Remember also, go to WDET.org and fill out our listener survey. Tell us what you think of Created Equal and all the other content you hear on 101.9 FM. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.